Now, I'd like to talk about what happens in one of the other genres, because there's one genre in which sonata form is modified a good bit in order to suit the essential nature of it, and that's the concerto. Now, a concerto, just to refresh your memory, who plays in a concerto? Okay, so you have exactly. You have a symphony orchestra plus a soloist, whatever that soloist, whatever instrument that soloist might play on. It's possible to have more than one soloist. In the classic era, this is unusual, but it's possible that you could have a concerto for violin and cello, or for two violins, or something like that. It's not very often that you find that. Brahms, in the Romantic period, Brahms, for instance, wrote a concerto for violin and cello and orchestra. Beethoven wrote what they call a triple concerto for violin, piano, and cello. And all three of those instruments sort of function as a solo ensemble, if that's not a contradiction in terms. But usually it's one instrument. And of course, that one instrument, the idea is that one instrument is, sometimes you can think of it as that one instrument pitted against the orchestra, but somehow the two, there should be a tension between the orchestra and the soloist, as each is are trading back and forth, and neither the soloist nor the orchestra should completely dominate over musically over the other. So there's that tension and balance, which is what gives the concerto form its very nature. Now, how many have had this experience? You go to a concert, and there's going to be a concerto, and it needs to be a classical concerto because Romantic and 20th century are a little bit different. But in some Romantic concertos, this happens. Let's say it's a piano concerto by Mozart. You go through all the usual stuff. The soloist comes out, and the conductor, and so forth, and everybody gets seated and ready to go. And the conductor gives the downbeat. And the soloist is sitting there at the piano, and just sits, and sits, and sits, for a good while. And you're sort of beginning to wonder what's going on here. And then finally, the soloist comes in, and then everything proceeds. Well, that's built in to classical sonata form as modified for the concerto. Basically what happens, let's go back to the exposition. One of the things we mentioned early on was that the exposition may be repeated. In most scores, that is in everything but concertos, you'll see repeat marks, and then it's up to the conductor or the performer, whoever it might be, to decide whether to go back and repeat it or not, which is why when we listen to these CDs, we never know until you actually hear the performance whether you're going to have that repetition. Well, it's handled a little bit differently in the concerto. Essentially, what happens is the first time through the exposition, the orchestra plays the material. That's why the soloist is sitting there. The soloist doesn't really come in until the second time through. And so it's not an exact repetition in the concerto in that sense. And it's not an optional repetition. You eliminate the repetition and then you'll have eliminated the soloist in a sense. So, and then when the soloist does play the second time through the material, he does not repeat it exactly. Sometimes there will be extra themes that the orchestra doesn't have, but more often the soloist will elaborate. You'll hear the theme, but it'll be in some way embellished or ornamented in various ways. And of course, this doesn't mean the orchestra is not playing. It's not strictly soloist. You will hear the orchestra, but what I'm talking about is the second time through, the soloist has the bulk of the melodic material. So that's one, and then from there on, for most of the rest of the movement, it's pretty straightforward. There's one other difference, however. You've probably, if you've been to this same concerto what we're talking about and heard this same performance or whatever it might be, you've probably had this experience. And that is, as you get to the end of the movement, somewhere near the end, the orchestra drops out entirely. And a soloist just takes off. And you have the feeling the soloist is literally doing that, just taking off on his own, you know, for a while. And then after a while, the orchestra comes back in. Well, that's all obviously built in and arranged. But in arranged in a way you may not realize. That solo passage near the end of the first movement, which means it usually occurs at the end of the exposition and early on in the coda, somewhere right around that area, is what we call a cadenza, C-A-D-E-N-Z-A. And essentially what that means is just a solo passage or a passage for the solo instrument alone. Now, if you're a classical composer, it's really easy to write a cadenza. How did Mozart write his cadenzas? I'll show you. I'll write a Mozart cadenza on the board for you. I'm going to have to erase a little bit of this. He comes to a certain chord. We won't get into that, but it's a variant of the tonic chord. And the whole orchestra comes to this same particular chord, quite loud. And then, if you look at the score, you see a fermata. And if you read music, you know that all that means is pause. That's essentially what it is. And then, the score will say something like this. Cadenza ad lib. So, the cadenza is actually not, strictly speaking, a part of the piece. It's an addition to the piece. Mozart, for instance, wrote most of his concertos for himself. He was a virtuoso pianist. And he would simply improvise the cadenza when he got to that particular point, as would a lot of other music. Beethoven would do the same thing. Now today, there are very few classical performers that would trust themselves to improvise at that moment. So most cadenzas are written out or are worked out ahead of time. But nevertheless, the idea holds that it's something that's added. Sometimes you will see, if you look, next time you go to a concert in which there's a classical concerto, and as I say, it has to be classical, because in the Romantic period, the composer tended to write everything out. Look in the program, and it'll say, cadenza by such and such, or something like that. Sometimes it's the performer who ahead of time has figured it out. Sometimes it's Mozart. Mozart actually wrote some cadenzas, but he didn't write them at the same time necessarily that he wrote the concerto, and it certainly was not meant to be part of the score. I think the reason he wrote the concertos he simply wanted to demonstrate to other pianists how a cadenza should sound. I don't have any hard evidence on this, but I have a feeling that Mozart probably heard his concertos being butchered by very inappropriate cadenzas, and so consequently he decided to write a few just to demonstrate. And often today, a performer will use one of those if it's for one of the concertos that Mozart wrote one for, assuming the fact, and I think rightly so, that, well, since Mozart wrote this out to demonstrate how a cadenza would sound, then it probably is going to sound pretty good in the piece. But that's the way it works. Now, that brings up one other little problem. Let's say you're the conductor. Okay? You get to this point. This is all you have in your score. So So, and the conductor does properly put down his baton. You know, he's not beating time or anything during the cadenza and is waiting for the soloist to finish. Now, sooner or later, the conductor has to bring the orchestra back in, right? I mean, you've got to end this thing. So, if you're the conductor, how are you going to know when to come back in? When for the orchestra to come back in? Well, there's a way. There is a convention that evolved over the years, and that is when the performer got through, he would trill on the note above the tonic. Let's say the concerto is in A, since the example we'll listen to is in A, and then so the note above the tonic is B, and so he would trill on that note. And then the orchestra comes back in. And if you listen to a classical cadenza, you'll hear that trill just about at the end of almost every one. In fact, what you'll often hear is a lot of other trills, too, on other notes, but not on the note above the tonic is called the supertonic, but not on the supertonic. They'll be on other notes. It's almost as if the performer is playing a game with the conductor just to see if he's awake and listening to whether, you know, he starts trilling on some other note. No, that's not the right note. Don't come in yet. And then he'll go on, the soloist will go on and do some other things and you'll hear a trill and so forth. So that's the way the concerto sonata form works.